From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the afterlife and channeling. Here's what's happening. A World Health Organization team has started its investigation into the origins of the coronavirus in China, despite concerns that the government there might try to block any embarrassing findings. 13 scientists arrived in Wuhan, China, following months of discussions with the government. The team includes virologists and other experts from the United States, Australia, Germany, Japan, Britain, Russia, Netherlands, Qatar, and Vietnam. They are going to attempt to go to the viral lab in Wuhan as well, as we've talked about for well over a year. Violent extremist activity will likely surge in the United States and pose the greatest domestic terrorism threat in 2021, according to a trio of federal law enforcement agencies, warning in a recent released bulletin. The FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and the National Counterterrorism Center announced in a joint intelligence bulletin that this threat comes from anti-government or anti-authority violent extremists. President-elect Joe Biden, who will get inaugurated next week, proposes spending $1.9 trillion as he unveiled a rescue plan for America. The president's massive multi-trillion-dollar stimulus package proposal that aims to combat the coronavirus and begins to pump up an economy severely battered by the worst pandemic to strike the globe in a century. The president-elect in an address to the nation from his hometown of Wilmington, Delaware, spelled out his plan to speed up the nation's COVID vaccination program, boost coronavirus testing capacity to help reopen businesses and schools, and provide an extra $1,400 in stimulus checks for Americans. Scientists claim they've created the first robot ever to display glimmers of empathy, overcoming a major obstacle that until now had proven elusive. Although it's still very early, scientists hailed a breakthrough after claiming to have developed for the first time a robot which they say demonstrates elements of empathy in the act of being aware of and experiencing the feelings and thoughts of others. Let's check in with our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Breggin. Peter, you talk a lot about empathy when you come on the program. This is amazing that they could have a robot to have the same feelings.
Well, George, you used the word feelings, and that's the naughty word in science. Actually, this is one of the dumber things I've ever looked at. But, you know, it tells us, one thing my wife learned from looking at the COVID-19 authorities and scientists is how shallow scientists can be about humanity and human life. This particular experiment, if I just make believe I'm nothing more than an artificial intelligence robot, I would analyze. And I would say, well, they compared a robot's choices of picking green, the nearest green object, and we created this robot that watches it and sees it's picking the most recent green object, and I'll do the same thing. In other words, it recognized pattern. Well, as an artificial intelligence robot, I'm insulted. I mean, I can work for Spotify, and I can spot music preferences. I can spot rhythm preferences, tonal preferences. I can count the words love that appear in a song. I'm way ahead of these stupid scientists, and I still don't know what feelings are because I looked up what empathy is. I'm the robot now, but I'm artificial intelligence, not this garbage. And I'm saying, all right, I can read the definition. You can understand or share the feelings of somebody else, and I don't know what that is.
Do you think it's a mistake to push artificial intelligence in that direction?
No, I don't think it's a mistake to push it in any direction where it will help us human beings with feelings to develop and recognize patterns and pick music we like more and give us shortcuts even to meeting a mate if you want on a dating. But what I object to is stupidity about the depth of empathy, because empathy requires this amazing ability to get a sense of another person's feelings, especially if they're suffering. Often that's even in the definition. Sense another person's feelings and relate to it. And that we need that right now. We don't even have it in an understanding of it.
We need a lot of that right now, Peter. Peter's website, BREGGIN.com. Illusionist Siegfried Fischbacher, the surviving member of the duo Siegfried and Roy, has died in Las Vegas at the age of 81. His family says that he died of cancer. You might remember that back in 2003, his partner Roy Horn, who died in May of this last year from COVID in a Las Vegas hospital, was 75. But back in 2003, he was attacked by one of their tigers during an act. The Mediterranean diet is getting some competition. The European Union's Food Safety Agency says, get this, folks, worms are safe to eat. The Parma-based agency published a scientific opinion Wednesday on the safety of dried yellow mealworms and gave them a thumbs up. Researchers said the worms, either eaten whole or in powdered form, are a protein-rich snack or ingredient for other foods. I think I'll pass. What's going on in the skies these days? UFO reports. Kevin Randall with us. Kevin, what do you got for us, my friend?
Well, hi, George, from the windswept and snowy plains of the Midwest.
Yes, indeed, cold. Starting to get cold again.
Absolutely. One of my reports on UFO occupants caught the attention of one of the listeners. He or she contacted me wondering how many UFO sightings included reports of the occupants. Then added this story, and I'll try to get through it without messing up because the syntax is a little bit off. One of my bosses in the Air Force said that one night he was flying and got a call from the air traffic control that he had a fast-moving traffic moving toward him. It slowed and then flew in formation with him for a bit. He did not describe it other than to say, I'm telling you this was a ship from another world. Then it did the usual zip maneuver, and the ATC said they'd lost track of it, end quote. Of course, we can't do much with the story without additional information. I find it interesting, but without being able to communicate with the actual witness, it just falls into the category of anecdotal evidence, which isn't much in the way of evidence, so to speak. It also reminded me of a story that I had heard while researching the Roswell case. I was told about a retired Air Force colonel who had been a pilot on Air Force One during the Kennedy administration. The story was that the man had flown the president out to a base to see the alien bodies recovered at Roswell. Wow. After a month, I found the man who confirmed for me that he was a retired colonel and he had been an alternate pilot on Air Force One. He had flown President Kennedy to various locations. And the colonel said that one night while flying a fighter, he had been approached by a domed disc. Through some sort of cockpit window, he had seen an alien pilot of the craft. He didn't get a good look at him, other than know that he wasn't human. I have more confidence in this report because I talked to the guy in person, but in the end, it too is anecdotal. Oh, and I should mention that all the elements of the rumor checked out except that Kennedy seeing the bodies from Roswell. I will note here that I don't know how many UFO reports contain descriptions of alien creatures. If we limit ourselves to Project Blue Book, there are three sightings labeled as unidentified that contain those descriptions. These are the Socorro and Lonnie Zamora sighting, of course. Then there is a Pittsburgh, Kansas sighting on August 25, 1952, and finally, Temple, Oklahoma on March 23, 1966. Other cases in the Blue Book involving occupants label the witness as either unreliable or as having psychological problems. I'll have a link to the unidentified sightings at my blog, www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com, tomorrow so they can take a look at those sightings.
Perfect.
And I have another occupant case that came in over the transom, which means that I have not had a chance to vet it. It comes from the Dallas-Fort Worth area. A couple in the area of south of Arlington reported they had seen a low hovering dome disc on January 8th of this year. Like the colonel, through a window, a porthole, or a cockpit windshield, they could make out the shape of what they thought of as a small humanoid creature. Given the distance, they couldn't see much detail other than they didn't believe it was human. After a minute or so, the object lifted up into the clouds and it was gone. I'll follow up on this as I can, but I don't have any additional information at the moment. That sort of covers it for tonight, George.
All right, Kevin. We'll talk to you next Friday, my friend. Great. Up next, the new Great Depression. Jim Rickards back with us on Coast to Coast, and get ready for that. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Jim Rickards back with us, editor of Strategic Intelligence, which is a financial newsletter. He is an investment advisor, a lawyer, inventor, economist. He's held senior positions at Citibank, long-term capital management, Caxton Associates. His clients have included institutional investors and governments as well. He is an advisor on capital markets to the U.S. intelligence community, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and is on the advisory board of the FDD Center of Economic and Financial Power in Washington, D.C. Jim Rickards, back on Coast to Coast with his latest work, which just came out, The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. How timely can that be, Jim?
Thank you, George. I hope we got the timing right. You know, when the book was originally scheduled to come out in October, but there were some real supply chain disruptions in the printing industry, not the publisher or me, but the printing industry. So we got pushed back to January, and I thought, well, gee, maybe the pandemic will be over, but it's actually worse than ever. So that's not good news, but the timing of the book actually couldn't be better.
Before we get into the new Great Depression, tell us about the old Depression. What happened then?
Sure, and that's a great question. And by the way, you have to look at the what I call the first Great Depression, 1929 to 1940, to understand what's going on now. This does not compare to the 2008 financial crisis. You have to go back to the 1930s to get the frame of reference right. Now, everyone knows that started in October 1929. The stock market crashed. It had a two-day 22% crash, but it didn't hit bottom until 1932. It took 3 years to work all the way down.
Did it go steadily down, or were there some ups and downs?
That's a great question, and there were ups and downs, and that fooled a lot of people because, you know, it went down sharply at the beginning, but then there was a rally, then down again, then another rally, and down again. So it was kind of this sort of jagged sawtooth pattern. But every rally ended up lower than the one before. So the trend was down, but there were all these rallies, they call them sucker rallies, that kind of fool people. But it hit absolute bottom in June 1932, but it was down 89.2%, so call it 90% for a round number. That's what a real stock market crash looks like. You know, today, the Fed props everything up. The stock market will go down 30%. But here comes the Fed to prop it up. But then it went down almost 90%. But then you ask people, say, well, okay, it hit the bottom in 1932, down almost 90%. When did it get back to the 1929 high? When did it recover all the losses? The answer is 1954.
Wow.
It took 25 years to come back. Now, that doesn't mean you couldn't make money. I mean, if you bought the low, you could have made money in 1933 and 1934. I'm not saying that you can't make money along the way, but it took 25 years to get to the old high. Some people didn't live that long. You know, they say, buy and hold, buy and hold. Well, I hope you live that long, because it took a quarter of a century to get back.
What caused that Great Depression?
Oh, well, that was, in a word, the Fed. The Federal Reserve caused it. Subsequent heads of the Federal Reserve, pardon me, have even admitted that. You got to get into kind of gold. We were on a gold standard at the time. The U.S. was accumulating a lot of gold. And I talked to Ben Bernanke about this, because he wrote a paper on it, and I read it, and we met, and I said, you know, Mr. Chairman, here's how I understand it. Do I have this right? And he said, yes, you do. But here's what he said. At the time, the money supply could be 2.5 times the gold supply. So take the amount of gold at the market. It was $20 an ounce at the time. And multiply that by 2.5, and that's how high the money supply could be. The actual money supply never got over 100%. In other words, the Fed could have more than doubled the money supply and still been on the gold standard, still adhered to the law at the time. They didn't. And so that was one failure. But then you say, well, why didn't they double the money supply? Why didn't they do that? Well, the answer is nobody wanted to borrow or spend. You know, you can print the money, but if you give it to the banks and the banks give it back to you, which is what's happening today and could have happened then, it doesn't do you any good. So printing money by itself does not bail out an economy. And then it was worse than that. So the Fed kind of messed it up by not expanding the money supply. But then world trade contracted. You started with currency wars, and then you had trade wars. People put up tariffs, and it just kept contracting. It was a race to the bottom. Unemployment went up. And they couldn't get out of it. We were caught in deflation. You know, people worry about inflation, and they should, and everyone remembers everyone was around at the time, I would include myself, remembers the great inflation of the late 1970s. But the problem then, and I think the problem today, is actually deflation. They couldn't get out of it until FDR did something in 1933 that I talk about in my book. There is a way out. FDR figured it out, but people have forgotten since then. So I kind of go back to that at the end of the book.
Now, when you talk about the new Great Depression and your book, of course, with that title, Is it because of COVID-19, or were there elements afoot anyway?
Well, it is because of COVID-19, but in a very specific way. And when this came out, my publisher called me last spring in April, and they said, you know, Jim, obviously we were in the thick of the pandemic. The stock market had fallen 30%. They said, Jim, we have to have a book on this. There's going to be enormous interest. Could you write it? And I said, yes, I could. And then we were outlining it. And they said, you know, we love you on, you know, the economy and capital markets and the depression, but keep away from the epidemiology. You know, you're not a doctor.
Right.
And I said, look, that's like asking me to write about property damage in New Orleans in 2005 and not mention Hurricane Katrina. I have to talk about the pandemic. And they finally agreed. And you know, I teased them. I said, well, I do have 2 degrees from Johns Hopkins University, so I'm not intimidated by natural science. I read over 100 peer-reviewed papers, you know, top, you know, the Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine. So it's comprehensible. I got into it. And this is the first book that covers both. It covers the pandemic and the depression. But specifically to answer the question, what I say is the virus did not cause the depression, but our response to the virus did. In other words, it's not the virus caused the pandemic, but we had choices as a country, as governments around the world, as individuals. We had choices. Some of those choices were badly bungled. We maybe talk more about the lockdowns and so forth, but it was our policy response to the pandemic that caused the economic collapse, and we're going to be stuck in it for a very long time.
It's going to take a while to dig out, is it?
Yes, absolutely. And there are specific reasons for that. I mean, but this is where you come back to your first question, the Great Depression of the 1930s. You know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s. It was a fairly prosperous time in the U.S. economy. I did not live through the Great Depression, but my parents did and my grandparents did. So I was kind of raised with a depression mentality, even though I was living in a pretty good time. You know, we would, with the newspaper in the morning, we'd take the rubber bands off and put them in a jar to ride through away a rubber band. And as little kids, we went out with our wagons door to door, and we collected newspapers and tin cans. And we weren't doing it for environmental reasons. Maybe it was good for that. But we were recycling. You could take these tin cans and melt them down and build airplanes and battleships. So that didn't change until the late 60s when the baby boom came of age. And then, you know, okay, credit cards and mortgages and leverage and, you know, rock and roll. In other words, the effects of the behavioral effects of the Great Depression lasted for 30 years. They lasted until the kind of mid to late 60s. Same thing is going to happen now. This, we'll get past this pandemic, not as soon as people think. It's going to last for a while, and we'll get past this new Great Depression, although that's going to last for a while. But the behavioral effects may go on for 30 years. You know, when I hear Jay Powell, he's the chairman of the Federal Reserve, say, we're not going to raise interest rates until 2023, I was like, well, thanks, Jay. Try 2043.
Yeah, I was going to say, God, what's a couple more years?
Yeah,
what about the Fed pumping all this money into the system and the stimulus packages, which are probably needed for people who need money, but what effect is that going to have on us, Jim?
It's not going to have the effect they expect. So first of all, you're absolutely right. The Fed has printed $4 trillion in the past year.
Jeez.
So go back to January.
This is new money, brand new money.
Brand new money out of thin air. So go back to January 2020. The Fed's balance sheet was about $3.6 trillion. Today, it's about $7.6 trillion. So with 1 year, they printed $4 trillion of new money. Now, over to the Congress, deficit spending. We had a $1 trillion deficit going in. That was the baseline deficit. We were starting with a $1 trillion deficit. They did about $3 trillion of spending packages in April, May, June of last year. That they just did about a week ago, another almost $1 trillion, $970 billion, right at the end of the Trump administration. The Biden team is promising, when they come in, another $2 trillion. So add it all up, that's $6 trillion on top of two $1 trillion deficits. So $8 trillion of deficit spending last year and this year. So you got $4 trillion of new money from the Fed, $8 trillion of deficit spending from the Congress. Those are just the numbers. And none of it's going to do any good in terms of stimulating the economy. Now, some of it's needed. So to the extent that they extended unemployment benefits, increased unemployment benefits, payroll protection plan loans, aid to hospitals, all these things did some good. I'm not saying they were all bad programs. That help was needed. But don't call it stimulus. I mean, people do. Is it money printing? Yes. Is it deficit spending? Yes. But it's not stimulus. It's not going to get us out of this depression.
Jim, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about your new work, The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. Jim Rickards, our special guest, will take calls with Jim next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Jim Rickards with us. His new book is called The New Great Depression. We're going to take calls with Jim next hour here on Coast to Coast. Jim, your reaction to the stimulus money going to individuals, initially now $600, maybe soon another $1,400, $2,000 total. Every penny counts, I think, but is that really going to help people?
It's not. Well, it may help people, but it's not going to stimulate the economy. Let me kind of break that down to yours and explain. So the money's going out the door. The people are going to get it. Now, Wall Street, by the way, which usually gets these things wrong, you know, the stock market did not see the dot-com crash, did not see the 2008 financial crisis coming, did not see this financial crisis coming. So the idea that Wall Street looks ahead and gets it right is nonsense. The data does not bear that out. But Wall Street's saying, okay, these, you know, $1,400 checks plus the other $600, so call it $2,000. The checks are going out the door. People are going to get them. They're going to run right out, you know, buy a new car, a new refrigerator, carpet the house, whatever. That's going to stimulate the economy. That'll actually cause a little inflation, you know, et cetera. That's not true. The checks are going out. The money is going to get to the people. What they're going to do, what they did the last time, they're going to pay down debt or save it. They're either, you know, if they owe some debt or if you owe your rent, you're going to obviously pay your rent or stick it in the bank. Now, if you're unemployed, you're definitely going to save it. You're not going out to dinner and, you know, taking your friends. You're putting the money in the bank. But even if you have a job, you're saying, well, gee, maybe my spouse lost her job or maybe my neighbor lost his job or maybe I'm next. You know, I have my job, but I'm going to get fired next week. So you put it in the bank. They actually call that precautionary savings, you know, saving for a rainy day. So the money's going to go out. People are going to get it, but they're not going to spend it. They're going to save it or pay down debt. That doesn't stimulate the economy. I'm not saying that savings is a bad idea. For individuals, it's probably a good idea. But when you apply that to the economy as a whole, 330 million people, if they're sticking it in the bank, they're not spending it. Our economy is driven by consumption and not by savings. So if you don't spend it and you save it, again, good for you as an individual, but bad for the economy. So the spending's real, the deficit's real, and the money's going out, but it's not going to stimulate the economy because people are not going to spend it. And that's just one more example of how, you know, people in Congress and Washington and Wall Street, they think they have these grand plans, but they don't think about real people. They don't think about real behavior. It's not going to work.
No, it's not going to work at all. H.G. Wells published The War of the Worlds back in 1898, and you have somehow tied this incredible science fiction story into the new Great Depression. Tell me about that.
Well, there are two ways, and you know, I know that story from a little kid, but I reread the novel recently, and boy, is it striking and up to date. Well, the first thing is, you know, the Martians landed. They had like a giant cannon. They fired it from Mars and landed. They came out and they had these war machines, these heat rays, and the, you know, tripod machines and heat rays. And they ran, and nothing could stop them. All the British military, you know, they landed outside of London. The British military couldn't stop them, and people were getting killed left and right. And, you know, they were taking over London, and it looked like they were going to take over the world. And then suddenly, the Martians died. They found them. The machines had crumbled, and the Martians were like blobs. They were dead inside the machines. What killed them? It wasn't the British military. It was a bacteria.
It was a virus bacteria.
Exactly. Yeah. They died of a disease that where they did not have the immunities. So first of all, this coronavirus came in, this COVID-19. We, you know, humans, did not have any immunity to it. It had never jumped to humans before. It had never been never infected humans. We did not have the immunity, so then many people got infected. Many people, you know, some cases were mild, some cases were severe. You know, Boris Johnson, Prime Minister of the UK, he almost died of it.
That's
and
right.
Sadly, they're having quite a few fatalities. So we didn't have this immunity to it. So that's the first parallel, which is, you know, the Martians died because they didn't have immunity. But there's another parallel, a little deeper, a little more interesting, that H.G. Wells set up. Because as you're reading the novel, you say, well, gee, they're outside of London. They're coming. But people in London, life was going on as usual. They didn't believe it. There was this denial, cognitive dissonance is the technical name. But, gee, hey, the Martians are coming. Why aren't you running for your life? Well, they didn't believe it. So there was this gap between the perception and the reality. The reality was the Martians were coming, and they were killing everything in their path. the perception was, I don't know, it sounds like a rumor, they're kind of far away, they're not here yet, etc. And of course, in the end, reality always wins, and London was destroyed in the novel. So apply that to today. So the stock market is at an all-time high. I mean, it is. It recovered the losses from the pandemic crash in the February, March, got back, and now it's at an all-time high. And yet, half the economy is being crushed. And people look down their nose at small businesses, you know, restaurants, bars, nail salons, boutique shopping, gas stations, et cetera. They go, oh, we want Apple, Netflix, Amazon, you know, and those stocks are going up and they're at an all-time high. But the gap between the Wall Street perception or even the everyday American perception that my 401k is back and the reality of a lockdown crushing half the economy, that is as wide as I've ever seen it. The reality is going to win. It always does. But the gap can last for a while. So I thought H.G. Wells did a really good job of portraying the perception that everything was fine versus the reality that, you know, death is coming your way. To today in the stock market, there's this perception that everything's fine, but it's not. The economy's in terrible shape.
Why hasn't gold and silver taken off like a rocket ship?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, gold has almost doubled in the last 5 years. So it the trend is up. But it's kind of what we were talking about before with the Great Depression, where the stock market, the trend was down, but it was jagged. There were these little peaks. Same thing with gold. The trend is up, and it's going to go a lot higher. But, yeah, you have these, you know, occasional dips, and we're in one right now. But each peak gets higher than the one before. That's the thing to watch. Now, right now, okay, so why is the gold price kind of stalled out? It's not crashing, but it's below the all-time highs. Well, the reason is that interest rates are going up. You know, you look at the 10-year Treasury note. That's a benchmark that traders and investors use. That's gone up from 0.9% to about 1.1%. So that's a pretty steep increase. So gold doesn't have a yield. I mean, gold is gold, but it doesn't pay you any interest. So if interest rates are going up, institutional investors say, well, give me some of those 10-year notes. I don't want the gold because, you know, I want to get that higher interest. So then if you want to predict the gold price, you have to say, well, what's going to happen with interest rates? And the answer is they'll probably go up a little bit more, and then they're going to come down very sharply. Because the economy's slowing. So, again, here's another case where, again, back to H.G. Wells. Wall Street says, you know, the checks are going out. People are going to spend the money. Inflation's on the way, so we need higher interest rates. The reality is the checks are going out. People are not going to spend the money. The economy is going to go back. We're in a new recession right now in the first quarter of 2021. And then eventually that Wall Street will wake up. Interest rates will come down and gold will go up. So right now it's kind of, you know, flattish. It's trading in a range. That's because of higher interest rates, but the interest rates are going to turn around. Because the reality is we're crushing half the economy with the lockdowns. By the way, lockdowns don't work. And that's not just an opinion. There's very good science behind that. They don't work to stop the spread of the virus, but they do crush the economy. And that's exactly what the governors and mayors are doing.
Jim, let's talk about China. They seem to be steamrolling, but they've got some internal problems too financially, don't they?
That's right, George. And I remember during the Cold War, we used to discuss nuclear warfighting strategies and military strategies. And, you know, there'd always be some general saying, you know, well, the Russians are doing this. And with the Soviets, you know, but it was essentially the Russians. They're doing this and doing that. And if you want to shut them down, you would say, who would you rather be, you know, us or them? And they go, well, I'd rather be the United States, of course. So same thing today. You know, China's, there's this perception they're a juggernaut. It's going to be the Asian century, the Chinese century, et cetera. And, you know, their economy has come back. Their military is expanding, and their technology is pretty good. But you wouldn't rather be China. They have enormous vulnerabilities. First of all, about 45% of their economy is investment. Now, normally, like the United States, for example, we're about 25% investment. So they're almost double investment. That can be okay if you're investing in productive assets that are going to pay a yield. They're not. I've been to China. I've been out to these ghost cities. I got mud on my boots, you know, looking at construction sites. And they build a ghost city. Okay, there's a couple skyscrapers, an apartment building, a resort center, a golf course, a transit stop, airport, the whole thing. And they're empty. I've been to them, George. They're empty. And I was with some, you know, Communist Party officials. They were showing me around. I said, this place is empty. And they go, oh, don't worry. It's going to fill up. It hasn't. You can't mothball a building. Yeah, you can mothball some old clothes, baby, but you can't mothball a building. It's actually people using it and maintaining it that keeps it going. So if you were using good accounting principles, you'd write it off to zero. So they've wasted that money. Yeah, you create some jobs. You buy cement and steel and glass. That's fine. But it's not sustainable. So they've got too much debt. The U.S. is cutting them off from technology because they've been stealing it. So we say, okay, enough of that. We're starting to blacklist their companies, which are also, you know, stealing intellectual property and feeding it right to the People's Liberation Army. So, okay, they've made great progress, but Xi is the new emperor. That's the, you know, Chairman Xi. He's the most powerful.
Yeah, he's going to be around a long time, isn't he?
He is, and he's the most powerful since Mao Zedong. And he's this idea that they were going to end up like us, like a democratic society, is nonsense.
Right. And he may be smarter than Mao Zedong.
Well, yes, and healthier.
In his way, that's right.
That's exactly right.
Now, you very astutely have pointed something out with what's going on with COVID-19. Yes, millions of people are infected. Yes, at least in the United States, 380,000 have died from this tragedy. They've died in Canada. But you point out that there's something else underlying here, and that is anxiety levels are at all-time. Suicides are high. Divorce rates are high. Civil unrest is out of control. There are disturbances and riots more than ever, and it's not just over the Trump factor. I think COVID has affected people's psyche. What do you think?
Well, I agree completely, and the evidence is there. And I have a whole chapter in my book, Chapter 5, just on the mental health aspects of this and the behavioral aspects. So, yes, I talk about the virus, and I talk about the lockdowns and the depression and the economy. That's all there. But there's a whole chapter on mental health. And, George, when I started writing the book, you know, it's one thing when you write a book, you do research, obviously, and you research other books on the same topic and learn as much as you can. But when I started this, there was no book on COVID. This is the first book on the COVID pandemic and the economy. So for my research, I went back to the Spanish influenza of 1918-1919. And in that one, 100 million people died. It was the greatest, highest fatality pandemic in the last 650 years, worse than the Black Death of the 14th century. So that's kind of your baseline. And the one strange thing about it is nobody wrote about it. You're like, wait a second, 100 million people died, more than in World War One. Why were, you know, great writers, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Despossos, not writing about this? And the answer is it happened during World War One, so in which 20 million people died. So it was almost like it was too much to process, or people were too traumatized. A little bit hard to explain, but clearly it warped the behavior, and that carried on for decades. Same thing today. So you're right. Suicide rates have tripled. Murder rates have doubled. Drug abuse is up. Alcohol abuse is up. Domestic violence is up. There's depression, anxiety, anger. You know, you tell someone they've got to quarantine or stay in an apartment for 3 months, which we did last spring. We're doing it again now. It's like being in jail. You get all kinds of, or worse maybe, you get all kinds of dysfunctional behaviors. So I looked at all that, and again, the data's there. And I looked at the riots last summer. And for that matter, you could look at the riot on Capitol Hill last week. You know, I'm against all the violence, so there's no question about that. But, you know, one was kind of coming from the left-wing progressive, another one coming from the right-wing. In a way, it doesn't matter. Take the politics out of it. And I say in the book, the virus is not a Republican or a Democrat. The virus just wants to kill you. And that's all you need to know. The virus wants to kill you. And so I connect the dots with, okay, forget the politics. This behavior, this anger, this depression, this dysfunctional behavior is built up. I expect more of it. That's a sad thing to say, but we can't ignore the mental health aspects of this. This will carry out, as they say, for a generation. This will be around for 20 or 30 years.
The book just came out, the new Great Depression. Where do people get it, Jim?
You can get it, obviously, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Pals online, and it's in the bookstores, so it's out actually all over the world. So I hope people have a chance to grab it and enjoy it.
Why is Bitcoin going crazy?
Well, that's a good one. You know, I did an interview in December 2017, and at the time, Bitcoin was going up about $1,000 a day. So it was $8,000, $9,000, you know, and so forth. And I said to the interviewer, and I don't own Bitcoin. I don't, you know, if you want to buy it, you know, knock yourself out. When I was a kid, there was a song called Shout, Shout, Knock Yourself Out. So, yeah, if you want to do it, that's fine. I don't own any, but that's just me.
It scares me.
What I said to the interviewer, I said, look, it was at $8,000 at the time. I said, it's going to go to $20,000 and then it's going to crash. And that's exactly what it did. Within a month, it went to 20,000.
Well, now it went to 40, but it's tailed down a little bit, right?
And it'll come down more. So it's, this idea that, somehow Bitcoin is going to replace the dollar as the global reserve currency. I mean, the dollar has its problems, but people don't understand reserve currencies. It's not like the People's Bank of China has $1 trillion of $100 bills, on pallets in the basement of their building. They don't. You need a bond market. They buy U.S. Treasury securities. They own the bonds, which, by the way, are in digital form. The greatest cryptocurrency is the U.S. dollar. I mean, it's overwhelmingly digital. You might have a couple bucks in your pocket. In Philly, we call it walking around money. But that's minuscule compared to the amount of digital dollars. And the message traffic is all encrypted. So the dollar is a cryptocurrency, if you want to call it that. But the problem with Bitcoin is there's no bond market. There's nothing to invest in. And you can buy a Bitcoin, but there are no Bitcoin securities, Bitcoin bonds, Bitcoin auctions. It doesn't have the legal payment infrastructure framework you need to have a reserve currency. So I prefer roulette, because I can have a nice drink and I enjoy it more. But look, if people want to buy Bitcoin, that's fine. That's up to them. But it's not going to replace the dollar. It's not going to replace anything.
Is it liquid enough to get out of?
Only in small quantities. If you saw a run for the exits, it would collapse. I'm not saying you couldn't execute, but it would collapse, literally 90% in a matter of days if everyone tried to get out at once. And the other thing that people don't understand about markets, George, is they go, oh, it went to 40,000, which it did. It's backed off from there. I know it's down in the 30,000s, 33,000, somewhere around there. But it only takes one transaction. So there's about $1 trillion of Bitcoin out there. If you took all the Bitcoin times the market price, it comes to $1 trillion. But if I want to, I only have to go buy like 100 Bitcoins to make the price go up. And then they take that price and apply it to all the Bitcoins. It's about 17 million Bitcoins, I believe, in circulation. I mean, they're not in circulation.
And if somebody wants out and dumps it, it plummets, right?
Correct. If a small seller meets a small buyer, okay, that transaction gets done. But if you have the equivalent of a run on the bank, it's going to crash so fast it'll make your head spin.
Jim, so we're going to come back and take some phone calls with you. We'll chat a little bit more about the new Great Depression, your book. Jim Rickard's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Your calls are next. We'll be back.